Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to, what is this place? It's Lost in Science, that's the one. It is, how could I forget? It is, you know, the best science show that I've ever heard. And I should know, I'm part of it. As is Lyndon. How are you, Lyndon?
I'm well, thank you, Chris. I agree. The best science show that I've ever heard of, that I am in right now. We're Lost in Science. You were lost about being lost in science. It can't be that time of year already.
What time of year even is it? Like, what is time? Oh, that's
is that what we're tackling today?
No, we should tackle that at some point. That's one of those perennial ones. I don't know if we actually tackled that properly. Back when I first started this show many years ago, I think I tried tackling time travel. And it's like, why would you even like attempt to talk about time travel with you don't even know what time is? So yeah, I don't know.
Yet another episode of Chris makes you feel fairly unstable on what you thought was a stable planet. Don't know what time is. Don't know what static electricity is. Don't know what friction is. Go to the back catalogue. Let Chris tie up your brain. Are you tying up our brain today, Chris?
No, I'm not tying up your brain. I might be, you know, I might be worrying some people. I might not be worrying other people. I don't know. There was a thing that I saw on the social medias a couple of weeks ago, a study purporting to show that the levels of carbon dioxide found in people's bloodstreams are rising as atmospheric carbon dioxide levels rise. And this is potentially a danger to human health. In fact, could be in 50 years be hazardous to human health. Like most things on social media, though, you kind of go, does this sound real? So I've looked more into the research, and it may or may not be real. I think we will dig into that and, try and find out what's going on. That's basically that.
That's exciting. I thought you were going to talk about CO2 outside our bodies. So to talk about CO2 inside our bodies for a change.
I'll leave the CO2 outside the bodies to you, Lyndon. That is more your, I was going to say hot air. I don't know. It's your breath of air. I don't know, but I haven't got a metaphor for that. What I do have, though, is a question. Do you have any science to talk about as well?
I do have some science to talk about, Chris, and I know that it's a little bit early to talk about it. Easter is a couple of weeks away, so we maybe shouldn't be talking about eggs just yet. Well, it's pretty close, actually, but I could not go past a story this week about dinosaur eggs. Dinosaur eggs, Chris. This story that was published earlier in the week, this research project from scientists in Taiwan exploring whether dinosaurs, a particular breed of or species of dinosaur, type of dinosaur, family of dinosaur, group of dinosaurs, type of dinosaurs, sat on their eggs or not. Were they more like chickens or penguins and kind of kept their eggs warm using their body heat? Or were they more like turtles and crocodiles and, you know, used the heat from sand or the heat from the sun to keep their eggs nice and warm and incubate them so they could hatch? Why is that a question we need to know the answer to? If you've got to ask me that, then you're not listening to the right show. I mean, you want to understand how these species evolved, how they behaved, how different characteristics might have evolved in the species that we know today. As you well know, Chris, modelling the heat transfer in different setups is incredibly tricky and messy, trying to understand the heat from a body, how it goes to an egg, how it is stored. Different fossils from different dinosaurs have been found in different positions. Anyway, the story I want to talk about today uses a physical model, as in they recreated a dinosaur nest and they recreated a dinosaur torso to understand how these eggs may have been kept warm. What does bubble wrap have to do with it? What does a high school student have to do with it? You'll just have to listen to find out. But this is the story. These are the stories that science is for, and I can't wait to talk about it.
Look, I thought I had a lot of questions about that, but then you threw in bubble wrap, and it's like, even more to learn. All right, well then, let us not waste any more time and on with the show. Okay, yes, you're listening to Lost in Science. Now, carbon dioxide, as we know, is like a bit of a problem, the rising carbon dioxide levels. I think most people would agree. Not everyone would agree.
99% of climate scientists would agree, and the vast majority of scientists studying other research topics that are related to how things live on the Earth would also agree. But continue.
Yes. Oh, no, I was going to take the opportunity, as we always do, to pick on, you know, the Trump administration and how they had the EPA, the American EPA, repealed its ruling that carbon pollution was a danger to human health. And so it was not, they are no longer allowed to regulate carbon pollution, to have rules about the amount of greenhouse gases emitted, because they decided that it's not a danger to human health, which would surprise most people seeing the impacts of climate change. Maybe not everyone, because we have our own kind of deniers here in Australia. But I think it's very kind of apropos that I am talking about a study that looks at the direct impact of carbon dioxide on human health, namely, if the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere increase, does this affect our biology, basically?
I mean, we know that increasing carbon dioxide affects plants a bit, you know, it can provide them with more food, and there's studies to suggest that, you know, more CO2, more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere can help plant biology in some ways, not always, but there is some evidence to suggest that. But when it comes to the human body,
that's an interesting point. I mean, when you're talking at plants, I mean, I suppose when you're looking at plant biology, we are looking kind of at the large scale and that sort of thing. And yes, you know, there can be a use, I believe, in horticulture of increasing carbon dioxide in greenhouses and that sort of things. I suppose when you're looking at, because plants breathe in carbon dioxide, as most people would be aware, we, of course, breathe in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. So high levels of carbon dioxide are certainly hazardous to human health, but that's normally at very high levels.
What are we talking? So the current amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is
about 420 parts per million. When I say very high levels, I mean, it can be toxic if it's like, you know, I think one of the figures I saw that, like, say 50% carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking like exceeding extremely high levels, not realistic in terms of what we're currently doing to the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So we know that because we need oxygen to breathe. Carbon dioxide is our waste product. Too much carbon dioxide is simply going to be a bad thing for our breathing. That's like a fairly basic thing. And, you know, if you are trapped in a closed room where there is no fresh air coming in, then yes, the increase in carbon dioxide and decrease in oxygen is going to be an important thing in your very short-term future. But we're not talking about it. As you said, the current atmospheric levels are about 420 parts per million, much less than that direct toxic effect, but it still has an effect on our bodies. So, and this is some work that was recently published by a couple of Australian researchers, Alexander Larcombe from the Kids Research Institute Australia, based at Curtin University, and Philip Beerwith, who I think is an emeritus professor from the ANU. And they looked at some American data on the from blood samples taken from 7,000 Americans every 2 years between 1999 and 2020. And they looked at the amounts of certain chemicals in their blood. So they looked at the markers of CO2 in their blood, carbon dioxide, as well as calcium and phosphorus. And basically what they found was that, there was an increase in Well, the actual is the bicarbonate levels in the blood. So when the carbon dioxide is in our bloodstream, it often is converted into bicarbonate, like you get in your bicarbonate of soda. This is, I guess, the chemistry that is applied to it. But it's also because carbon dioxide, when it dissolves in water, for instance, or blood, makes it more acidic. And we don't want the blood to become too acidic. Bicarbonate is alkaline. So essentially what you're doing there is counteracting the acidity of the carbon dioxide with increased levels of bicarbonate. And so, yeah, that's what they found. And two other chemicals they looked at, which is calcium and phosphorus, which are also related to the body's control of its acidity levels, were found to decrease in the same period of time. So, yeah, they found about a 7% increase in the bicarbonate levels, which is the main one we're looking at, which measures essentially the amount of carbon dioxide that's getting into the blood over the period from 1999 to 2020. And it kind of, it's not a straight line, but it kind of increases at the same level as, say, the atmospheric carbon dioxide levels are increasing.
But is that, you're going to answer my question before I ask it, I'm sure.
Okay, well, ask it. Go ahead, ask the question.
Well, I wanted to know whether the researchers put forward a hypothesis for why that might be. You know, a lot of other things change over those 20 years. Diet in particular is what I'm thinking of. Did the researchers explore whether it was a change in what we eat or a change in what we breathe or a change in what we're drinking that has led to this increase? And 7%, I guess that's pretty significant over a 20-year period.
Well, okay, so the things we don't know is, you're quite right, we know there's a correlation. We don't know the exact causation. We also don't know how bad this is, I suppose. So in terms of the correlation kind of factor of it, yes, there could be other things going on with the diet. You know, this is related to, it is the kidneys essentially that control the acidity of the body and of the blood. So there could be something affecting kidney function, but I suppose that is raising another level of complexity on top of the equation. You know, you can easily go, can easily look at, you know, the carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, the air we're breathing increasing. We know that affects the levels of bicarbonate in the blood. You see the bicarbonate increasing. There's kind of an obvious cause and effect there. If something else is doing it, it is kind of, I guess, less obvious, so a bit harder to track down. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of thing where you say more research is needed. But there could be other things actually that are directly causing this as well, because one thing that we know is that, I mean, this is only a fairly short term, I suppose, like we're looking at like 20 years period, but we know that, for instance, people are spending more time indoors, mm-hmm. and carbon dioxide levels are much greater indoors in closed rooms than they are outside. So that is actually one of the bigger concerns in this kind of calculation, because we look at the levels just in the normal air due to carbon emissions, and that's, you know, that where that is certainly increasing, but that's also not the level that we're breathing all the time.
Yeah. What did they address that in the study? Much higher.
Well, again, they don't really know. Like, they've got this correlation, but they don't really know. They sort of pointed that out. So what they've looked at is they kind of tracked it and seeing the direction it's going, and so this continued to increase, and it was following, say, carbon dioxide increases, then it could reach a level in 50 years that is considered to be not in the healthy range for bicarbonate in the blood. Doesn't mean we know what will happen if it exceeds that, because there are a lot of people who say that, you know, the bodies can adjust and we have actually good mechanisms for dealing with this. So we actually don't know what the effect is going to be. But at, you know, you also don't know if there is something else causing it, whether that could also make it worse or not. You know, we've seen since the COVID pandemic that there's been a bit of a tension, which, like you talked about, on air quality, indoor air quality. Mm-hmm. We also know that due to the pandemic, we've spent a lot more time indoors. So it is something that, for instance, that kind of effect could become more pronounced. It might become less pronounced. It might clean up our act and open windows more.
Yeah,
we'll
go outside more.
Yeah.
There's very little evidence, I guess, apart from maybe increased risk of being hit by a car, that going outside is bad for you. There's much more evidence to suggest that going outside is good for you. And this seems to be another piece on that very large pile.
oh, look, you're always, I was going to say you're big outdoors, you're representing here. But no, I guess you're right. You're right there. But yeah,
great outdoors. I'm here for them.
That's right. But yeah, we also, like I said, we don't know how bad this could be. Now, there's some researchers, one of the researchers in particular had a few years ago published a study where they looked at exposing mice to high levels of carbon dioxide and found that it caused changes to their lung development. And so there wasn't, the levels that they looked at there was about, I think, about 890 parts per million, which is what we could conceivably get to later this century if the carbon dioxide continues to increase in the atmosphere. And that did, produce notable changes to the lung. But again, I couldn't find really in that research what the actual real effect of those changes were. Like, it was certainly the lungs weren't behaving as normal, but did this affect the, you know, in terms of the ability of the mice to function or not, was not clear. So yeah, there's a lot of unknowns about this research. I suppose the alarming thing is that from a very basic level, you can look at, we have evolved at a certain level of gas concentration in the atmosphere, and if you change that, it is likely to have an effect. We know that there have been studies on people spending a lot of time indoors and high carbon dioxide concentrations, and that can lead to some issues like cognitive fatigue and this sort of stuff. So it can, at very high levels, can harm people's performance. That may be what we end up all having all the time. But yeah, there are a lot of unknowns, and there does need to be more research done. It's just, I think it's interesting that it's something to get to panic about, but it's interesting that there are signs that this is a real effect, and it's something that I guess we hadn't thought of, or I certainly hadn't thought of when I we think about greenhouse gas emissions. So yeah, just something else to be alarmed about as you don't open your window in the morning.
So social media wasn't really gaslighting you then.
Very good. Very good.
Got one.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
The science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far?
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
Welcome back. You are listening to Lost in Science, and from a possibly terrifying future to a fascinating and maybe terrifying past, let's talk about some dinosaurs now, Chris. What's your favourite dinosaur?
Look, this is a question that with young children, comes up more than normally does. I've had to think about it because, there's a lot of there's a lot of dinosaurs I like for various reasons. But I think as a kid, Brachiosaurus was actually my favourite, I reckon.
Yeah, Brachiosaurus, classic. Mm. Yeah, I liked a Stegosaurus.
Oh, yeah.
The plant eaters. We like the plant eaters by the sound of it.
Look, they come in weird shapes, don't they?
What about a word I should have practiced saying before I met you in the studio today? Heiyuani Huangi.
I'm not familiar with that one. I am aware, though, that there, since I was a young child, there have been a lot of dinosaurs discovered in China. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of Chinese names that I do find difficult to pronounce. So I suspect it's one of those.
Yes, good job. Well deducted, Chris. Yes, this is a flightless oviraptor, which was part of the collection of dinosaurs that lived about from 70 to 66 million years ago. This one is lived in what is China today, and they're about 20 kilos and about a meter and a half long. So
okay,
that's pretty. That's like the size of the weight
of
a little
dog.
Yeah, a dog sized.
Yeah,
and so these. This species of dinosaur, these oviraptors, lay eggs, as lots of dinosaurs do. But there's always been a bit of an open question as to how they manage to incubate their eggs. So fossils of this dinosaur have been found in the US and a lot in China. They're much more partial in the US. And they've been found near nests that are ring shape. So the eggs are in rings. And it's not just, you know, like a one layer. It's a multi-layered ring where you kind of have some eggs be on the top and then some would be kind of on the outer but underneath and some would be on the inner, outerneath.
Okay. Hang on. You said it's an oviraptor. Why are they called oviraptors?
I believe oviraptor means egg-stealing dinosaur.
Yes, are they found near eggs? Are they sure that their nest that they're found near, or is it someone else's nest? Just throwing that out there.
That is beyond the scope of this current conversation. Okay. I'm not sure. No, these researchers seem to be fairly confident that the nests that they have found, they must match the size of these oviraptors. It's not necessarily that you would have one female laying all the eggs. I think it's multiple females that have laid these eggs in these rings. But there was always a bit of a mystery as to how you could incubate them. If they were sat on, like chicken eggs are sat on, and the warmest part of the chicken body kind of touches all of the eggs a certain amount to warm them up so they all hatch, then that wouldn't really work because you've got this egg ring.
There's too many of them,
Yeah. And if they were heating at different times or if they were being heated from underneath by warmth from the sand, then the ones that were underneath would hatch before the ones on the top and then you'd have a bit of an issue. So this was a question that has puzzled researchers who are looking at these oviraptors. And as I said in the intro, modelling how heat is transferred either through the torso of the animal, like the parent, or through sand or whatever particular soil is looking after the nest, quite tricky to do because there's a lot of different permutations and combinations and heat transfer equations to use. And so this study that was published in Frontiers in Ecology and Evolution from a group of Taiwanese researchers thought, let's just do it. Let's just build the nest. The study was led by a high school student who was, I think, doing an internship with the senior researcher and the other team. I don't have evidence to support that. I've looked everywhere to figure out who this student is. But the student, Chunhu Su, led the study and probably was one of the lead people involved in building the model. So they obviously didn't have eggs, so they recreated what they thought an oviraptor egg would look like out of resin, and then they stuck a bunch of electrodes in it to kind of measure the temperature differences. They did an outer ring and then a center ring and then an inner ring. So the middle of the nest is kind of empty. And then they recreated the torso using polystyrene foam and wood for the frame, and then they used cotton, bubble wrap and cloth for the soft tissue, and then they kind of warmed it up, I guess. The eggs were molded from a resin and, they were arranged in these rings. And then they kind of did it out on some dirt and they measured all the temperature differences to try to understand how these eggs may have been incubated.
So like these particular dinosaurs, like we know that these raptors often had feathers. Mm-hmm. Did they have feathers on their torso model as well? Because like when you think of a chicken sitting on its egg, you think of it all, or a penguin, you think them all, they're the little fluffy little kind of enclosure from the feathers. Mm. Surely that's a factor as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But I think actually what's more important is the section underneath, you know, the bottom part of the penguin or the underneath part of the chicken that's not quite so feathery. And so the maximum amount of warmth from the body can get transferred to the egg. I think it has a technical name, but I can't remember what it is. Our chicken listeners will certainly let us know. So, I think that probably played a role and was a part of how they reconstructed this torso. So if you look at a picture of the torso, the oviraptor torso that was built, it sort of has this kind of cape on top of it that spreads out over the nest.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So they measured the different temperature differences between the eggs on the inside, the eggs on the outside, to try to understand how warm they can get and how evenly distributed the warmth could be. And they realized that actually the theory of parent-based incubation wouldn't work because there wasn't enough warmth being transferred from the body to the eggs. Right. And there was also quite a big temperature difference, right? Up to 6 degrees between some of the eggs on the inside versus some of the eggs on the outside, which meant that they would be hatching at different times. Maybe right. that's a mechanism, but more likely probably not an ideal thing to be happening.
So look, I think we went in going expecting that maybe this wouldn't work. So did they figure out how the eggs were incubated then?
What do you mean this wouldn't work? Do you think that
I'm thinking, like, if you've got a big ring, multiple rings of eggs, and you've got one little dinosaur sitting on it, it seems unlikely it's going to be able to incubate them all evenly. I mean, that seems pretty clear.
Yeah, because again, that's true.
You know, you compare it to your birds, like your chickens and penguins, and most of the birds, they don't lay large numbers of eggs. They only have a couple at a time, really.
Yeah, but then the other theory that the dinosaur just lays the eggs in a ring and then nicks off, a la your turtle or your crocodile, that kind of falls apart as well, because I think the fossils have been found very close to the eggs and so suggests that there is some parental input. And that was the finding of this study, okay. that it was co-parenting or co-incubating with the sun, essentially.
Okay.
So the research suggests that the parent dinosaur is there to protect the eggs from too much sun or to help if it gets too cold, and then to evenly distribute the heat when the sun is up. That does the main part of the incubation. So it's a team effort.
You do see that with some reptiles, that they mm-hmm. will they'll maintain their nests and move eggs around to get the optimum temperature. But we also see with some birds that lay their nests out in the open, and say lay their eggs out in the open and guard them, and they don't necessarily sit on them the whole time. They will have an egg just sitting there, and the parent birds will essentially guard the nets. Yeah. I mean, I believe masked lapwings do this. Mm-hmm. You're kind of fairly vicious little swooping.
But there is normally a parent sitting on that egg, and it's the other parent that does the guarding, right?
No, I think that they. I could be wrong on this because I remember I did a story on masked lapwing eggs a while back. I think they're often not sitting on it, and that mm-hmm. the baby birds can actually call to their parents from within the egg. I believe bushstone curlews also mm-hmm. lay their eggs out in the open. So maybe it depends on the climate as well, if the climate is suitable for this approach. And then it really is about making sure for the parent to make sure that the eggs are doing okay and they are at the right temperature, but they don't have to sit on it the whole time.
Yes, exactly. And this research kind of intimated that same thing, although with fewer callbacks to Australian bird species, saying that, if the climate was warm, then the sun was doing most of the heavy lifting. And so, there's been a bit of media about this, actually, because there's some great pictures of the reconstruction of the nest and the model of the torso. And some of the headlines around the place have been, dinosaurs haven't incubated their eggs as well as modern chickens and those kinds of things. But the researchers are very clear to stress that it's not better or worse. It's just different. There are just different styles. Just like there's different styles of parenting, just like there's different favorite dinosaurs. There's no right or wrong. And now we've got we've got some clear physical reconstructed evidence about how that happens.
And that's it for another episode of Lost in Science. Lost in Science is recorded for 3CR in Melbourne on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. And it airs across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We would love you to get in touch with us. You can email us at lostinsci@gmail.com, or you can find us on Facebook, we're Lost in Science on 3CR, or on Twitter, where we're at lostinscience1. You can find us on your favourite podcast app, where if you get the chance, please give us a good rating and review, as that will raise us up in the search rankings so other people can find the science. Or you can listen to us however you listen to us now, where the same time every week, Claire, Stu and Chris get
Lost in Science!
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.